Muhammad, Disc 3.
The chief vice of the Kafirun was Jahiliya. Muslims have traditionally used this term to refer to the pre-Islamic period in Arabia, and so it is usually translated the time of ignorance. But although the root word jahil has some connotations of ignorance, its primary meaning is irascibility, an acute sensitivity to honour and prestige, arrogance, excess, and above all, a chronic tendency to violence and retaliation. Jahili people were too proud to make the surrender of Islam. Why should a noble hero moderate his behaviour and act like a slave, praying with his nose on the ground and treating the base-born like equals? The Muslims called Abu al-Hakam, their chief enemy, Abu Jahil, not because he was ignorant of Islam, he understood it all too well, but because he fought Islam arrogantly, with blind, fierce and reckless passion. But the tribal ethos was so ingrained that, as we shall see, Muslims continued to exhibit Jahili symptoms long after they had converted to Islam. Jahiliya could not be eradicated overnight, and it remained a latent menace, ready to flare up destructively at any moment. Instead of succumbing to the Jahili spirit, the Quran urges Muslims to behave with hilm, a traditional Arab virtue. Men and women of hilm were forbearing, patient, and merciful. They could control their anger and remain calm in the most difficult circumstances instead of exploding with rage. They were slow to retaliate. They did not hit back when they suffered injury, but left revenge to Allah. Hilm also inspired positive action. If they practiced hilm, Muslims would look after the weak and disadvantaged, liberate their slaves, counsel each other to patience and compassion, and feed the destitute, even when they were hungry themselves. Muslims must always behave with consummate gentleness and courtesy. They were men and women of peace. As the Quran says, "For true servants of the Most Gracious are they who walk gently on the earth, and who, whenever the Jahilun address them, reply, 'Peace.'"
After the affair
of the so-called satanic verses, the conflict with the Kafirun became very nasty. Abu Jahil regularly subjected any Muslims he met to vitriolic verbal abuse and slandered them with vicious lies and rumour. He threatened merchants with ruin and simply beat up the weaker Muslims. The Kafirun could not hurt Muslims who had strong protectors, but they could attack slaves and those who lacked adequate tribal patronage. Umayyah, chief of Jumah, used to torture Bilal, his Abyssinian slave, by tying him up and forcing him to lie exposed to the gruelling sun with a huge boulder on his chest. Abu Bakr could not bear to watch Bilal suffering, so he bought him from Umayyah and set him free. He also liberated a Muslim slave girl when he saw Umar ibn al-Khattab flogging her. Some of the younger Muslims were locked up by their families, who even tried to starve them into submission. The situation became so serious that Muhammad sent the more vulnerable members of the Ummah, the community, to Abyssinia, where the Christian governor gave them asylum. It was becoming painfully clear that, unthinkable as it might seem, there might be no future for the Muslims in Mecca. It must have been very difficult indeed for the Muslims, brought up in the Jahili spirit, to practice hilm and turn the other cheek. Even Muhammad sometimes had to struggle to maintain his composure. One of the early surahs expresses his rage against his uncle, Abu Lahab, and his wife, who used to scatter sharp thorns outside his house. On one occasion, Muhammad overheard some of the Quraysh chiefs jeering at him contemptuously while he was circumambulating the Kaaba. For a while, he was able to keep his rising anger in check. But by the time he had completed the third circuit, his face was as black as thunder. He stopped in his tracks, faced the Kafirun, and instead of wishing them peace, as the Quran enjoined, said grimly, "Will you listen to me, O Quraysh? By him who holds my life in his hand, I bring you slaughter." He uttered the last word so threateningly that the chiefs were silenced. But the next day they had recovered their nerve. They leapt on Muhammad when he arrived in the haram, encircled him menacingly, and started to rough him up, pulling him about by his robe. This time Muhammad did not respond aggressively, but allowed the chiefs to manhandle him until Abu Bakr intervened, weeping, "Would you kill a man for saying Allah is my Lord?" But this kind of behaviour could sometimes be counterproductive. One day, Abu Jahl came upon Muhammad near the Safa gate, an important site of the Hajj, and was so incensed to see him calmly occupying this sacred spot that he exploded in true Jahili style. Again, Muhammad refused to retaliate, but sat and listened to the string of devastating insults without uttering a word. Abu Jahl ended his tirade and went to join some of the other chiefs in the haram, while Muhammad went sadly and silently home. But that evening his uncle Hamza, who had been out hunting, heard what had happened and became incandescent with fury. He set off immediately to find Abu Jahl and hit him hard with his bow. "Will you insult him when I follow his religion?" he yelled. "Hit me back if you can." Loath to take on Hamza, whose physical strength was legendary in Mecca, Abu Jahl hastily restrained his companions, admitting that he had grievously insulted Muhammad. Hamza became a devout Muslim, but this was not exactly the way that Muhammad would have wished his uncle to enter Islam. Toward the end of 616, there was another, even more surprising conversion. Omar ibn al-Khattab had decided that it was time to kill Muhammad and strode through the streets of Mecca, sword in hand, toward a house at the foot of Mount Safa, where he heard that the Prophet was spending the afternoon. He didn't know that his sister Fatima and her husband had secretly become Muslims. Thinking that Omar was safely out of the way, they had invited one of the few literate Muslims to come and recite the latest surah. But on his way to Mount Safa, Omar was intercepted by another Muslim, who, fearing for Muhammad's life, informed Omar that his own sister had converted to Islam. Omar rushed home and was horrified to hear the words of the Quran issuing from an upstairs window. "What is this balderdash?" he roared as he burst into the room. The reciter fled in terror, dropping the manuscript in his haste, while Omar threw his sister to the ground. But when he saw that she was bleeding, he felt ashamed, picked up the manuscript, and began to read the surah. Omar was one of the judges of the poetry competition in Ukaz, and realized at once that he was looking at something unique. This was quite different from a conventional Arabic ode. "How fine and noble is this speech," he exclaimed with wonder. And immediately the beauty of the Quran diffused his rage and touched a core of receptivity deeply buried within him. Yet again, he grabbed his sword and ran through the street to the house where Muhammad was. "What has brought you, son of Khattab?" asked the Prophet. "I have come to you to believe in God and his apostle and what he has brought from God," Omar replied. Muhammad gave thanks so loudly that everybody in the house, who had dived for cover as soon as they saw Omar, came out of hiding, scarcely able to believe what had happened. Historian Ibn Ishaq has recorded another, less dramatic but equally significant version of Omar's conversion. He had set out to join some friends for a drink in the market one evening. But when his friends failed to turn up, decided to perform the circumambulation around the Kaaba instead. The Haram was entirely deserted, except for Muhammad, who was standing close to the Kaaba, reciting the Quran quietly to himself. Omar decided that he wanted to listen, so he crept under the damask cloth that covered the shrine and edged his way round until he was standing directly in front of Muhammad. As he said later, there was nothing between us but the cover of the Kaaba. All his defences but one were down. Then the power of the Quran did its work. "When I heard the Quran," Omar said, "my heart was softened and I wept, and Islam entered into me." Omar's conversion was a bitter blow to the opposition, but because he was protected by his clan, there was nothing that they could do to hurt him. Abu Jahl now imposed a boycott on the clans of Hashim and Al-Mutalib. Nobody could marry into them or trade with them. They could not even sell them food. All the members of Hashim and Al-Mutalib, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, moved into Abu Talib's street, which became a little ghetto. When Muhammad's household arrived, Abu Lahab and his family moved out and took up residence in the district of Abd Shams. The purpose of the boycott was not to starve the two clans, but to bring home to them the consequence of removing themselves from the tribe. If Muhammad wanted to withdraw from the religious life of Mecca, he could not continue to benefit from the economy. The ban collapsed after 3 years. It was especially unpopular among those who had relatives in Hashim or Al-Mutalib and could not, in good conscience, allow them to go hungry. Muslims like Abu Bakr and Omar, who did not belong to the proscribed clans, sent provisions whenever they could. One Meccan regularly loaded a camel with supplies, led it to Abu Talib Street under cover of night, gave the beast a thwack on its hindquarters, and sent it lumbering down the alley. On one occasion, Abu Jahl accosted one of Khadija's nephews, who was making his way to the ghetto with a bag of flour. There was soon a fierce argument. Another Qureshi joined in, disgusted that Abu Jahl was preventing a man from taking food to his aunt, and gave him a huge blow with a camel's jaw that knocked him to the ground. During this ban, the Quran reminded the Muslims that other prophets, Joseph, Noah, Jonah, Moses, and Jesus, had also warned their people to reform their behaviour, and when they had refused, their societies had collapsed because they were not acting in accordance with the fundamental principles of the universe. Unlike animals, fish, or plants, which are natural Muslims since they submit instinctively to these basic laws, human beings have free will. When they oppress the weak and refuse to share their wealth fairly with the poor, this violation of God's law is as unnatural as though a fish were to try to live on dry land. Disaster was inevitable. But the Quran continued to urge Muslims to be patient and not to seize this opportunity for a personal vendetta against their enemies. Some of the Quraysh, too, were anxious for peace. After the imposition of the ban, a small delegation had approached Muhammad, led by a venerable elder who was too close to death to be personally threatened by the Prophet. He suggested a compromise. The whole city could worship Allah one year and the other gods the next. But Muhammad could not accept this offer. Instead, the Surah Al-Kafirun proposed peaceful coexistence. "You, Kafirun, who reject the faith, I do not worship what you worship, and you do not worship what I worship. I am not a worshipper of what you worship. You are not a worshipper of what I worship. A reckoning, a din, for you, and a reckoning for me." People worship different things. There must be, as the Quran says, no coercion in matters of faith. Din meant reckoning, but also religion, way of life, or moral law. Each individual had his or her own din, and there was no need for force or compulsion. In the end, blood loyalty led to the end of the boycott. Four of the Quraishian establishment, who had relatives in Hashim and al-Muttalib, solemnly requested an end to the ban, and despite the angry protests of Abu Jahl, the other chiefs agreed. There must have been great rejoicing in the Muslim community. When they heard the news, some of the emigrants came home from Abyssinia, convinced that the worst was over. But they had been too optimistic. Early in 619, Khadija died. She was aging, and her health may have been irrevocably damaged by the food shortages. She had been Muhammad's closest companion, and nobody, not even Abu Bakr or the fervent Omar, would ever be able to provide Muhammad with the same intimate support. The early biographers call 619 Muhammad's year of sadness. Not long afterwards, a second death had even more far-reaching implications. Abu Talib had been ruined financially and may also have been physically weakened by the boycott. Later that year, he fell ill and died. And the new chief of Hashim was the hostile Abu Lahab. Chapter 3. Hijra. Everybody in Mecca was immediately aware of Muhammad's new vulnerability. Abu Lahab did not repudiate Muhammad. A chief was expected to give all his clansmen a measure of protection, and to fail in this duty at the very start of his office would have been a sign of weakness. But it was obvious that he extended his patronage very grudgingly. Muhammad's neighbours played disgusting tricks with the sheep's uterus, thwacking him with it while he was at prayer, and once even dropping it into the family cooking pot. One day, a young Qureshi threw filth all over Muhammad while he was walking in the city. When his daughter Fatima saw him in this state, she burst into tears. "Don't cry, my little girl," Muhammad reassured her tenderly while she tried to clean him up. "God will protect your father." But to himself he added grimly, "Quraysh never treated me thus while Abu Talib was alive." His weakness probably affected the position of some of the more vulnerable Muslims. Abu Bakr, for example, had been almost ruined by the boycott. He lived in the district of the Juma clan, and its chief, the corpulent Umayyah ibn Khalaf, who used to expose Bilal to the sun, now felt free to do the same to Abu Bakr, tying him to his young cousin and leaving them, parched and sick, in this humiliating position in the sweltering heat. Time, their clan, was too weak to protect them. So, realizing that he had no future in Mecca, Abu Bakr set off to join the Muslim emigrant community in Abyssinia. But on the road, he met Ibn Dugunna, one of the Bedouin allies of the Quraysh, who was horrified to hear what had happened. He insisted on returning to Mecca and formally took Abu Bakr under his own protection. Since the Quraishian establishment was anxious to cultivate Ibn Dugunna, they agreed to this arrangement, but asked him to make sure that Abu Bakr did not pray or recite the Quran in public. He was so popular and charismatic, they explained, that he would lure the young men away from the official religion. So Abu Bakr worshipped alone, making a little masjid, a place for prostration, in front of his house. But the situation was clearly unsatisfactory. Muhammad tried to find a new protector for himself in the pleasant, fertile oasis of Taif, but it was a hopeless venture, which revealed the measure of his desperation, because the tribe of Thaqif had been greatly offended by Muhammad's repudiation of their goddess Alat. Muhammad visited three of the leaders of Thaqif, asking them to accept his religion and extend their protection to him. But they were so enraged by his effrontery that they had their slaves chase him through the streets. He was only able to escape by diving into the garden of Utba ibn Rabia, one of the chief Meccan Kafirun, who had a summer home in Taif. Utba and his brother Shaiba saw Muhammad's humiliating flight, but did not wish to hand a fellow tribesman over to the Thaqif. So, instead of reporting Muhammad, they sent a slave to him with a platter of grapes.
Crouching ignominiously behind a tree, Muhammad was close to despair. It was customary for Arabs to take refuge with a god or a jinni in times of crisis. So now, Muhammad took refuge with Allah. O God, to thee I complain of my weakness, my little resource and lowliness before men. O most merciful, thou art Lord of the weak, and thou art my Lord. To whom wilt thou confide me? To one afar, who will misuse me? Or an enemy, to whom thou hast given power over me? If thou art not angry with me, I care not. Thy favour is more wide for me. I take refuge in the light of thy countenance, by which the darkness is illumined, and the things of this world and the next are rightly ordered, lest thy anger descend upon me, or thy wrath light upon me. It is for thee to be satisfied, until thou art well pleased. There is no power and no might save in thee. It is unusual for the historian Ibn Ishaq to give such an intimate account of Muhammad's state of mind. It indicates a moment of spiritual truth. In this act of Islam, of surrender, Muhammad realized more fully than ever before that he had no security and no true protector but Allah. God seemed to answer his prayer, because no sooner had he finished speaking than Adas, Utba's slave boy, arrived with the grapes. He was a Christian, and Muhammad was delighted to learn that he came from Nineveh, the city of the prophet Jonah. He told Adas that Jonah was his brother, because he was a prophet too. Adas was so overwhelmed that, to the disgust of Utba, who was watching the encounter, he kissed Muhammad's head, hands and feet. After this unexpected encounter with one of the people of the book, Muhammad felt less isolated. It reminded him that even though the Arabs had rejected him, there was a multitude of worshippers in the great world outside Arabia who would understand his mission. He felt cheered as he began his homeward journey and stopped to pray in the small oasis of Nakhla, where he was overheard by a group of jinn, of unseen beings. The word jinn did not always refer to the whimsical sprites of Arabia. It could also be used for strangers, people who had hitherto been unseen. The Quran indicates that the travellers, who lurked out of sight in Nakhla, listening to Muhammad's recitation, may have been Jews. They were so overcome by the beauty and felicity of the Arabic scripture that when they returned home, they told their people that they had heard a revelation bestowed from on high after that of Moses, which confirmed the truth of the Torah and would guide human beings to the right path. Muhammad's horizons were beginning to expand. He had been certain that he had been sent simply as a warner, a nadhir, to his own tribe, and that Islam was only for the people of Mecca. But now he was beginning to look further afield to the people of the book, who had received earlier revelations. Despite the confidence that this gave him, he was now desperate. Once the Kafirun had learned of his attempt to find support in Taif, his position would be even more precarious. So, before entering Mecca, he sent word to three clan chiefs, asking for their patronage. Two refused, but the third, Mutim, chief of Naufal, who had been one of those who had campaigned to end the boycott, promised to protect Muhammad, and he was now able to return home. But this could not be a long-term solution. Somehow, Muhammad had to win over the Quraysh. In 619, he began to preach to the pilgrims and merchants who attended the trade fairs that culminated in the Hajj. Perhaps, like Abu Bakr, he would find a Bedouin protector. And if the Quraysh establishment saw that he was respected by their Bedouin confederates, they might learn to accommodate him. But the Bedouin pilgrims were hostile and insulting. The last thing they wanted was a religion that preached submission and humility. Muhammad must have felt that he had come to the end of his resources. He was still grieving for Khadija. His position in Mecca was desperately precarious, and after preaching for 7 years, he had made no real headway. Yet, at this low point of his career, he had the greatest personal mystical experience of his life. He had been visiting one of his cousins, who lived near the Haram, so he decided to spend the night in prayer beside the Kaaba, as he loved to do. Eventually, he went to sleep for a while in the enclosed area to the northwest of the shrine, which housed the tombs of Ishmael and Hagar. Then it seemed to him that he was awakened by Gabriel and conveyed miraculously to Jerusalem, the holy city of the Jews and Christians, an experience that may have been recorded by this oblique verse of the Quran. Limitless in his glory is he who transported his servant by night from the inviolable house of worship to the remote house of worship, the environs of which we had blessed, so that we might show him some of our symbols. Jerusalem is not mentioned by name, but later tradition associated the remote house with the holy city of the people of the book, the Jews and the Christians. According to the historian Tabari, Muhammad told his companions that he had once been taken by the angels Gabriel and Michael to meet his fathers, Adam in the first heaven and Abraham in the seventh, and that he also saw his brothers, Jesus, Enoch, Aaron, Moses, and Joseph. The Quran also claimed that Muhammad had a vision beside the lote tree, which marked the limit of human knowledge. He saw it descending another time, at the lote tree of the furthest limit. There was the garden of sanctuary, when something came down over the lote tree, enfolding. His gaze did not turn aside, nor go too far. He had seen the sight of his Lord, great signs. The Quran is reticent about this vision. He saw only God's signs and symbols, not God himself, and later mystics emphasized the paradox of this transcendent insight in which Muhammad both saw and did not see the divine essence. Later Muslims began to piece together these fragmentary references to create a coherent narrative. Influenced perhaps by the stories told by Jewish mystics of their ascent through the seven heavens to the throne of God, they imagined their prophet making a similar spiritual flight. The first account of this night journey, Isra, is found in the 8th century biography by Ibn Ishaq. In this extended story, Gabriel lifted the prophet onto a heavenly steed, and together they flew through the night to Jerusalem, where they alighted on the site of the ancient Jewish temple, the remote house of the Quran. There they were greeted by Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and all the great prophets of the past, who welcomed Muhammad into their fellowship and invited him to preach to them. Afterwards, the prophets all prayed together. Then a ladder was brought, and Muhammad and Gabriel climbed to the first of the seven heavens and began their ascent to the divine throne. At each stage, Muhammad met and conversed with some of the greatest of the prophets. Adam presided over the first heaven, where Muhammad was shown a vision of hell. Jesus and John the Baptist were in the second heaven, Joseph in the third, Enoch in the fourth, Moses and Aaron in the fifth and sixth, and finally, Muhammad met Abraham in the seventh, on the threshold of the divine realm. Most writers leave the final vision of God in reverent obscurity because it was literally ineffable, lying beyond the reach of speech. Muhammad had to abandon ordinary human concepts, going beyond the lote tree, the boundary of mundane knowledge. Even Gabriel could not accompany him on this last stage of his journey. He had to leave everybody and, the later mystics insisted, even himself behind to lose himself in God. The story of the night journey and the heavenly ascent is an event that, in some sense, happened once, but which also happens all the time. It represented a perfect act of Islam, a self-surrender that was also a return to the source of being. The story became the paradigm of Muslim spirituality, outlining the path that all human beings must take, away from their preconceptions, their prejudices, and the limitations of egotism. The vision did not result in a Quranic revelation. It was a personal experience for the Prophet himself. But placed as it is by the early biographers at this particular moment of Muhammad's life, it is a wonderful commentary on the deeper subtext of these external events. Muhammad was being compelled by circumstances over which he had little control to leave Mecca and everything that was dear and familiar to him, at least for a while. He had to move beyond his original expectations and transcend the received ideas of his time.
Arabian ode,
the poet usually began with a zikr, a remembrance of his lost beloved, who was travelling with her tribe further and further away from him. In the next section, the bard embarked on a night journey, breaking out of his nostalgic reverie and setting off alone across the steppes on his camel. A fearful trek during which he had to confront his own mortality. Finally, the poet was reunited with his tribe. In the final section of the ode, he proudly boasted of the heroic values of his people, their prowess in battle, and their ceaseless war against all strangers who threatened their survival. In Muhammad's night journey, these old tribal values were reversed. Instead of returning to his tribe, the Prophet travelled far away from it to Jerusalem. Instead of asserting his tribal identity with the arrogant chauvinism of Jahiliyyah, Muhammad surrendered his ego. Instead of rejoicing in fighting and warfare, Muhammad's journey celebrated harmony, transcendence of the blood group, and the integration with the rest of humanity. The story of the night journey reveals Muhammad's longing to bring the Arabs of the Hijaz, who felt they had been left out of the divine plan, into the heart of the monotheistic family. This is a story of pluralism. Muhammad was abandoning the pagan pluralism of Mecca because it had degenerated into the self-destructive arrogance and violence of Jahiliyyah. But he was beginning to embrace monotheistic pluralism. In Jerusalem, he discovered that all the prophets, sent by God to all peoples, are brothers. Muhammad's prophetic predecessors do not spurn him as a pretender, but welcome him into their family. The prophets do not revile or try to convert each other. Instead, they listen to each other's insights. They invite the new prophet to preach to them. And, in one version of the story, Muhammad asks Moses for advice about how frequently Muslims should pray. Originally, God wanted Salat 50 times a day, but Moses kept sending Muhammad back to God until the number of prescribed prayers had been reduced to 5, which Moses still found excessive. The fact that this appreciation of other traditions is written into the archetypal myth of Muslim spirituality shows how central this pluralism was to early Islam. From this point, the Quran began to emphasize this shared vision. In one remarkable passage, Allah makes it clear that the faithful must believe indiscriminately in the revelations of every single one of God's messengers. Say, "We believe in God, and in that which has been bestowed from on high upon us, and that which has been bestowed upon Abraham and Ishmael and Isaac and Jacob and their descendants, and that which has been vouchsafed by their sustainer unto Moses and Jesus and all the other prophets. We make no distinction between any of them, and unto him do we surrender ourselves." You could not be a Muslim unless you also revered Moses and Jesus. True faith required surrender to God, not to an established faith. Indeed, exclusive loyalty to only one tradition could become shirk, an idolatry that puts a human institution on the same level as God. This is one of the first passages in the Quran to emphasize the words Islam and Muslim, which both derive from the verb aslama, surrendering oneself entirely to someone else's will. The verse continues, "For if one goes in search of a religion other than self-surrender, Islam, unto God, it will never be accepted from him, and in the life to come he shall be among the lost." This verse is often quoted to prove that the Quran claims that Islam is the one true faith and that only Muslims will be saved. But Islam was not yet the official name for Muhammad's religion, and when this verse is read correctly in its pluralistic context, it clearly means the exact opposite. The Quran depicts one prophet handing on the revelation to another. The message passes from Abraham to Ishmael and Isaac to Moses and so on in a continuous narrative. The Quran is simply a confirmation of the previous scriptures, and the Torah, the Gospel and the Quran are simply moments in God's continuous self-disclosure. Verily, those who have attained to faith in this divine writ, as well as those who follow the Jewish faith and the Sabians and the Christians, all who believe in God and the Last Day and do righteous deeds, no fear need they have, and neither shall they grieve. There was no thought of forcing everybody into the Muslim Ummah, the Muslim community. Each of the revealed traditions had its own din, its own practices and insights. "Unto every one of you have we appointed a different law and way of life," God told Muhammad. And if God had so willed, he could surely have made you all one single community. But he willed it otherwise, in order to test you by means of what he has vouchsafed unto you. Vie then with one another in doing good works. Unto God you must all return, and then he will make you truly understand all that on which you were wont to differ. God was not the exclusive property of one tradition, but was the source of all human knowledge. "God is the light of the heavens and the earth," Allah explained in one of the most mystical verses in the Quran. The divine light could not be confined to any individual lamp, but was common to them all, enshrined in every one of them. The parable of this light is, as it were, that of a niche containing a lamp. The lamp is enclosed in glass, the glass shining like a radiant star. A lamp lit from a blessed tree, an olive tree, that is neither of the east nor the west, the oil whereof is so bright that it would well nigh give light of itself even though fire had not touched it. Light upon light. The olive tree signifies the continuity of revelation, which springs from one root but branches into a multitudinous variety of religious experience that cannot be confined to a single faith or locality, and is neither of the East nor the West. Muhammad's position in Mecca remained dangerously insecure. During the Hajj of 620, he again visited the pilgrims who were camping in the valley of Mina, going from tent to tent in the hope of attracting support and protection. This time, instead of wholesale rejection, he met a group of six Arabs from Yathrib, who had camped in the gully of Aqaba. As usual, Muhammad sat with them, explained his mission, and recited the Quran. But this time, he noticed that the pilgrims were attentive and excited. When he had finished, they turned to one another and said that this must be the prophet expected by their Jewish and Hanafi neighbours. If Muhammad really was the messenger of Allah, he might be just the person to solve the seemingly insuperable problems of Yathrib. Yathrib was not a city like Mecca, but a series of hamlets, each occupied by a different tribal group and each heavily fortified. The settlement was situated in an oasis, a fertile island of about 20 square miles, surrounded by volcanic rocks and uncultivable stony ground. Some of its inhabitants engaged in trade, but most were farmers, making a living out of their dates, palm orchards, and arable fields. Unlike the Quraysh, they were not wholly dependent upon commerce and had retained more of the old Bedouin values, including, unfortunately, an entrenched hostility to other tribal groups. As a result, the oasis was engulfed in an escalating series of apparently unstoppable wars. The area had originally been cultivated by pioneering Jewish settlers, and by the 6th century there were about 20 Jewish tribes in Yathrib, many of whose members may have been Arabs who had assimilated to Judaism. They preserved a separate religious identity, but otherwise were almost indistinguishable from their pagan neighbours. Clan and tribal loyalty came first, and there was no united Jewish community. The Jewish tribes formed separate allegiances with Arab groups and were often at war with one another. Their date crop had made them rich, but they were also skilled jewellers, manufacturers of weapons, and craftsmen. The five largest Jewish clans, Thalaba, Hudl, Quraiza, Nadir, and Kainuka, the last of which controlled the only market in Yathrib, had achieved an almost complete monopoly of the economy that they had pioneered. During the 6th century, the Arab tribe of the Bani Qaila had emigrated from South Arabia and settled in the oasis alongside the Jews. They then formed two distinct clans, Aus and Khazraj, which eventually became two separate tribes. Gradually, the Arabs acquired their own land, built their own fortresses, and by the early 7th century were in a slightly stronger position than the Jews. But despite the inevitable competition over resources, Jews and pagans were able to coexist. The Jews often employed the Arabs to transport their dates, while the Arabs respected the skills and heritage of the Jews, seeing them as a people of high lineage and properties, whereas we were but an Arab tribe who did not possess any palm trees nor vineyards, being people of only sheep and camels. But by the time of the pilgrims' meeting with Muhammad in 620, the situation had deteriorated. The ingrained tribal rivalry had surfaced, and Aus and Khazraj were now engaged in a bloody conflict with one another. The Jewish clans had become involved in their struggle, Nadir and Quraiza supporting Aus, while Kainuka was allied to Khazraj. By 617, there was stalemate. Neither side could gain ascendancy. Everybody was exhausted by the violence. At certain key moments, Abdullah ibn Ubay, a chief of Khazraj, had stood aloof from the fighting and thus acquired a reputation for impartiality. Some saw him as a possible king or supreme chief who could enforce law and order. But the Arabs were averse to monarchy, and this type of experiment had never worked well in the peninsula. The Aus were naturally reluctant to hand the leadership to a member of Khazraj, while the other chiefs of Khazraj were equally unwilling to relinquish their power to Ibn Ubay. The six pilgrims immediately realized that as the spokesman of Allah, Muhammad would be a far more effective arbitrator, or hakam, than Ibn Ubay. They had no problems with his religious message, because for some time the Arabs of Yathrib had been drifting towards monotheism. The Aus and Khazraj had long felt inferior to the Jews because they had no scripture of their own, and the pilgrims were thrilled to hear that God had finally sent a prophet to the Arabs. They made their formal surrender to God on the spot with high hopes. "We have left our people, for no tribe is so divided by hatred and rancor as they. Perhaps God will unite them through you. So let us go to them and invite them to this religion of yours. And if God unites them in it, then no man will be mightier than you." But they admitted that they had little influence in the oasis and needed to consult their chiefs and wise men. If he was to be an effective arbitrator, it was essential that he have wide support. They promised to report back to Muhammad in a year's time. It was a decisive moment. Circumstances had forced Muhammad to look beyond Mecca, and even to entertain the extraordinary idea of abandoning his tribe to take up permanent residence with another.
While awaiting developments in Yathrib,
Muhammad made some changes in his household. He needed a wife, and it was suggested that he should marry Sauda, the cousin and sister-in-law of Suhail, the devout pagan chief of the Quraishan clan of Amir. She had been married to one of the Muslims who had migrated to Abyssinia in 616, but was now a widow, and this was a good match for her. Abu Bakr was also anxious to forge a closer link with the prophet, and proposed that he should marry his daughter Aisha, who was then 6 years old. Aisha was formally betrothed to Muhammad in a ceremony at which the little girl was not present. In later years, she recalled that the first inkling she had of her new status was when her mother explained to her that she could no longer play in the streets, but must invite her friends into the family home. Muhammad's harem has excited a good deal of prurient and ill-natured speculation in the West. But in Arabia, where polygamy was more common than the monogamous marriage that Muhammad had enjoyed with Khadija, it would have been commonplace. These marriages were not romantic or sexual love affairs, but were undertaken largely for practical ends. Sauda seems to have been a rather homely woman who was past her first youth, but she could take care of Muhammad's domestic needs. Muhammad may also have hoped to win over Suhail, who was still undecided about the revelations. There was no impropriety in Muhammad's betrothal to Aisha. Marriages conducted in absentia to seal an alliance were often contracted at this time between adults and minors who were even younger than Aisha. This practice continued in Europe well into the early modern period. There was no question of consummating the marriage until Aisha reached puberty, when she would have been married off like any other girl. Muhammad's marriages usually had a political aim. He was starting to establish an entirely different kind of clan, based on ideology rather than kinship. But the blood tie was still a sacred value and helped to cement this experimental community. During the Hajj of 621, the six converts from Yathrib duly returned to Mecca, bringing seven others with them. Again, they met Muhammad in the Gully of Aqaba, and, in what would become known as the Pledge of Aqaba, promised to worship Allah alone, to refrain from stealing, lying and infanticide, and pledged to obey Muhammad's directives concerning social justice. In return, Muhammad promised them paradise. The emphasis was on religion and ethics, and there was, as yet, no political commitment. When the pilgrims returned to Yathrib, they took with them Mus'ab ibn Umayyah, a trusted Muslim, to instruct the people of Yathrib in their new faith. This was a wise move. Tribal hatred was so intense in the oasis that neither Aus nor Khazraj could bear to hear a rival leading the prayers or reciting the Quran, so it was important that these offices were performed by a neutral outsider. At first, the Aus were antagonistic to the faith, but gradually the power of the Quran broke down their reserves. One day, Sa'd ibn Mu'ad, chief of one of the leading Aus clans, was horrified to hear that Mus'ab was preaching in his territory. So he dispatched his second in command to drive him away, who bore down on the little group, brandishing his lance, and asked the Muslim how he had the temerity to spread these lies among weak, foolish people. But instead of retaliating with Jahili rage, Mus'ab quietly asked him to sit down and judge for himself. The deputy agreed, stuck his lance in the ground, and, as he listened to the recitation, his face changed. "What wonderful and beautiful discourse this is," he cried. "What does one do to enter this religion?" After he had proclaimed his faith in Allah and prostrated himself in prayer, he went back to report to his chief. Sa'd was furious, grasped his own lance, and marched off to confront Mus'ab himself, only to be overwhelmed in his turn by the Quran. He then summoned his people and asked them to follow him. Trusting his leadership implicitly, the entire clan converted en masse. The news of Sa'd's dramatic about-face made a great impression on other chiefs, who began to take Mus'ab more seriously. It was not long before there were Muslims in almost every family in the oasis. In Mecca, Muhammad's preaching mission had stalled, largely because the Quraysh could not believe that such an ordinary person could become the messenger of Allah. But conditions in Yathrib were different. Muhammad was no commonplace fellow who could be seen strolling around the marketplace and eating and drinking like anybody else, but a remote, mysterious figure whose coming was eagerly anticipated. In Mecca, Muhammad's teaching threatened to damage the cult of the Haram, which was crucial to the economy. But there was no sanctuary full of idols in Yathrib. Not everybody was enamoured of the new faith, however. Ibn Ubay naturally feared that his position was being undermined. Others were still committed either to the old paganism or to the Hanifiyya. But at this stage, the opposition was muted. If the new prophet really could solve the problems of Yathrib, there might be some material advantage to be gained from him. The Jewish tribes were also prepared to give Muhammad the benefit of the doubt, especially since the Muslims honoured their prophets and had adopted some of their own customs. Muhammad had recently introduced some new practices. As a result of the night journey, perhaps, Muslims now prayed facing the direction, or Qibla, of Jerusalem, reaching out to the holy city of the people of the book. Muhammad had also instructed Mus'ab to hold a special prayer meeting on Friday afternoon, while the Jews were preparing for their Sabbath, and to fast with the Jews on Yom Kippur. Muslims would now pray in the middle of the day, as the Jews did, and observe a modified version of the Jewish dietary laws, similar to those adopted by the early Christians. Used to think that Muhammad introduced these new devotions in order to appeal to the Jews of Yathrib. But this view has recently been challenged. Muhammad would not have expected the Jews to convert to his religion because they had their own revealed din. God had decreed that each community should have its own messenger. But it was natural for Muslims to pray and fast in the same way as the other members of the Abrahamic family. In 622, a large party of pilgrims left Yathrib for the Hajj. Some were pagans, but 73 of the men and 2 of the women were Muslims. Yet again, Muhammad went out to greet them at Aqaba, but this time the meeting took place at dead of night. On this occasion, there was a sense of menace and of bridges being irrevocably burned. The Quran speaks of the scheming of the Quraysh. Perhaps Muhammad had reason to believe that the Kafirun were plotting to expel him and bar the Muslims from the Haram. At all events, Muhammad was now taking practical steps to leave his tribe. Ibn Ishaq claims that this was a positive decision on his part, but the Quran repeatedly claims that the Muslims were expelled or driven out of Mecca. The meeting was conducted in deadly secrecy. The Muslims from Yathrib did not even mention it to the pagans in their party, in case they gossiped and alerted the Quraysh to what was afoot. Muhammad was about to do something absolutely unprecedented. He was asking the Muslims of Mecca to make a hijra, migration, to Yathrib. This did not merely involve a change of address. The Muslims were about to abandon their kinsfolk and accept the permanent protection of strangers. In Arabia, where the tribe was the most sacred value of all, this amounted to blasphemy. It was far more shocking than the Quranic rejection of the goddesses. There had always been a system of confederation whereby an individual or an entire group could become honorary members of another tribe. But these were usually temporary arrangements and had never entailed alienation from one's own people. The very word hijra suggests a painful severance. The root hijra has been translated, he cut himself off from friendly or loving communication or intercourse. He ceased to associate with them. Henceforth, the Muslims who made the hijra to Yathrib would be called the muhajira, the emigrants. This traumatic dislocation was central to their new identity.
The Muslims of Yathrib were also embarking on a dangerous experiment.
Even if a foreigner was adopted by a tribe, he always remained a zalim, an outsider, a word which carried the connotation base, ignoble, evil. Poets described the zalim as a useless, superfluous accretion. Tribal loyalty was experienced as burning love of kinsfolk and harsh contempt for the alien. Anybody who put a despised zalim before his own people invited passionate scorn and revulsion. But now the Aus and Khazraj were about to swear allegiance to the Qureshi, Muhammad, and promising to give protection and military help to a large group of outsiders who would inevitably put a strain on the limited resources of the oasis. Henceforth, the Muslims of Yathrib would be known as the Ansar. This is usually translated the helpers. But this gives a somewhat anemic impression of what was involved. Narsa, or help, meant that you had to be ready to back up your aid with force. When they met Muhammad that night in Aqaba, the helpers had decided to make a second pact with Muhammad, which would be known as the Pledge of War. When the time came, the Ansar left their pagan companions sleeping in their tents and stole softly like sand grouse to Aqaba, where they met Muhammad and his uncle Abbas, who acted as his spokesman. Abbas had not converted to Islam, and he must have been shocked by Muhammad's decision to leave Mecca, but he wanted to make sure that he would be safe in Yathrib. Muhammad, he said, was protected by the Hashim in Mecca, but was ready to forego this security in order to join the Ansar. If they had the smallest doubt about his safety,
they should give up the entire project immediately. But the Ansar stood firm. Bara ibn Murur, a chief of Khazraj, took Muhammad by the hand and swore that Aus and Khazraj would both extend to Muhammad exactly the same protection as they gave to their own women and children. But while he was speaking, another helper interrupted. What if Muhammad went back to Mecca and abandoned Yathrib to the wrath of the Quraysh? Muhammad smiled and replied, I am of you and you are of me. I will war against them that war against you and be at peace with those who are at peace with you. And so the Ansar made this solemn oath. We pledged ourselves to war in complete obedience to the Apostle, in weal or woe, in ease and hardship and evil circumstances, that we would not wrong anyone, that we would speak the truth at all times, and that in God's service we would fear the censure of none. The pact was couched in tribal terminology and concentrated on mutual defence. There was as yet no thought of a single united community. Aus, Khazraj and Quraysh would still operate separately. Muhammad would not go to Yathrib as head of state, but simply as the Hakam, the arbitrator of disputes between Aus and Khazraj, and as the chief of the emigrants from Mecca. The Ansar would be ruled by 12 overseers from the various clans. Great strides in Yathrib. After a single year, the Muslim community there was almost as large as the beleaguered Ummah in Mecca. The fact remained that even after the Hijra, the Muslims would remain a tiny minority in the oasis, dwarfed in size by the aloof appraising pagans, Hanifs and Jews. The pledge of war marked a major expansion of Islam. The new religion had spread to other tribal groups, but it had not yet transcended the tribal ethos. The Hijra was a risky enterprise, an irrevocable, frightening step. Nobody knew how it would work out, because nothing quite like it had ever happened in Arabia before. After the Hajj, the Ansar returned to Yathrib to await the arrival of the Muslim fugitives. The Quran now adopted the Aramaic name that the Jews gave to the settlement of Yathrib. Medinta, the city. Yathrib was about to become Al-Madinat, the city of the Prophet. In Mecca, Muhammad began to persuade Muslims to make the Hijra, but he did not command it. Anybody who felt it to be beyond his or her strength was free to remain behind. But during July and August 622, about 70 Muslims set off with their families to Medina, where they were lodged in the houses of the Ansar until they could set up their own homes. The Quraysh do not seem to have made a concerted effort to detain them, though some women and children were forcibly prevented from leaving, and one man was carted back in triumph, tied to his camel. For their part, the Muslims were careful not to draw attention to their flight, and usually agreed to meet up outside the city limits and to travel in small, unobtrusive groups. Omar left with his family. Uthman ibn Affan and Ruqayya made the journey with Zayd and Hamza, but Muhammad and Abu Bakr stayed behind until nearly everybody had left. But it was not long before this major defection left disturbing gaps in the city, revealing the open wound that Muhammad had inflicted on his tribe. The big houses in the middle of Mecca looked desolate and portentous to passers-by. Doors blowing to and fro, empty of inhabitants. In August, shortly before he was due to leave, Mutim, Muhammad's Meccan protector, died. Muhammad's position in Mecca was now untenable, because he was fair game for assassination. There was a special meeting to discuss his fate in the assembly, from which Abu Lahab pointedly absented himself. Some of the elders simply wanted to throw Muhammad out of Mecca, but they were overruled by those who felt that to allow him to join these unprincipled renegades in Yathrib would be dangerous.
Abu Jahl came up with a plan. Each clan would select a strong and well-protected young man. Collectively, they would represent the entire tribe and would kill Muhammad together. There would be no vendetta because the Hashim could not take on the whole of Quraysh.
A band of carefully chosen youths gathered outside Muhammad's home, but were disturbed to hear the voices of Sauda and some of the Prophet's daughters through the window. It would be shameful to kill a man in the presence of his women, so they decided to wait until he left the house the following morning. One of them peered in and saw a figure lying in bed wrapped in Muhammad's cloak. Unbeknownst to them, Muhammad had already escaped through a back window, leaving Ali lying apparently asleep wearing his clothes. When Ali strolled outside the next morning, the young men realized that they had been tricked, and the Quraysh offered a reward of 100 camel mares to anybody who would bring Muhammad back, dead or alive. By this time, Muhammad and Abu Bakr were hiding in a mountain cave just outside the city. They stayed there for 3 days, and from time to time their supporters slipped out to bring them news and provisions. At one point, it was said, a search party actually passed the cave, but did not bother to look inside because an enormous spider's web covered the entrance, and a rock dove, who had clearly been sitting on her eggs for some time, had her nest in an acacia tree in exactly the place where a man would have to put his foot when climbing into the cave. All the while, Muhammad experienced a deep calm and a strong sense of God's presence. The Quran recalls how he comforted Abu Bakr, "Grieve not, verily God is with us." And thereupon, God bestowed upon him from on high his gift of inner peace. Increasingly, the Quran would insist that when Muslims found themselves in frightening or disturbing circumstances, they should be serene and tranquil, and should never fall prey to the impetuous rage and vengeful fury of Jahiliyyah. When the hue and cry had died down, Muhammad and Abu Bakr climbed out of the cave, taking care not to disturb the rock dove, and mounted the 2 camels that Abu Bakr had prepared for their journey. Abu Bakr wanted to give the better camel to Muhammad, but he insisted on paying for her. This was his personal hijrah, his sacrifice to Allah, and it was important to make the whole event entirely his own. Muhammad called the camel mare Qaswa, and she remained his favourite mount for the rest of his life. It was a dangerous trip, because while he was on the road, Muhammad did not enjoy anybody's protection. So their guide took them by a circuitous route, and they zigzagged back and forth to throw any pursuers off the scent.
This ends Disc 3.